is the singularity here?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture
be as gods, you know, catapulted propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location in a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
It's that time of year when things go bump in the night, but our cultural fascination with Halloween belies an ignorance of what the season truly means. Our guest has become sort of a regular at this time of year, although we're happy to talk to him anytime because it's always a fascinating conversation. He is the man behind the book Interview with the Giant, Ethnohistorical Notes on the Nephilim. His research into Panias, the Grotto of Pan, was fascinating and helped me to begin to understand a little bit better the true spiritual nature of the war, the spiritual war in which we're all deployed. He's also written The Paranormal Big Country and a new book that we will discuss tonight called Sanguis. His website is Burton Beyond. We welcome once again our friendly neighborhood PhD, Dr. Judd Burton. Judd, good to talk with you again, brother.
Good to talk with you, Derek.
Well, for those who may not have heard our previous conversations around this time of year, let's dig a little bit back, dig a little bit again into the history of Halloween. What is exactly the holiday about, and how do we as Christians then participate, if at all?
Well, the celebration of Halloween is so ensconced in American society that we've taken it on as kind of our own, but the roots of it actually go back to pre-Christian Europe and quite possibly into prehistory. But generally the line of its history can sort of be drawn back to the agrarian festivals of pagan Europe. One in particular, in the Celtic tradition, Samhain, which was the Celtic word for November, marked the beginning of the Celtic New Year. And this was the time that the Celts believed, and to a degree, other indigenous peoples in Europe believed that the veil between the land of the living and the realm of the dead was the thinnest, and so that the most communication and the most transference of energies, if you will, could be affected during that time. And
now, Samhain is the word that, if we're looking at it through our American eyes, looks like Samhain, correct?
That's correct. It looks like Samhain, but the Celtic pronunciation is Samhain.
Samhain, okay.
And, but, you know, I'm taking out my Texas draw, of course. You know, just, it doesn't look like it, like to our English reading, English-speaking eyes, it doesn't look like it sounds. But this festival and the analogs that you find for it in period Europe was celebrated as this time of spirits were abroad and people could allegedly communicate with their dead ancestors. The traditions that are associated with Halloween today, like trick-or-treating, jack-o'-lanterns, and things of that, can all be traced back to Druidic tradition and the sort of trick-or-treating comes from leaving goods for these spirits. And, the jack-o'-lanterns were actually carved in turnips.
Really?
Before the festival was actually brought to the United States, the Irish used turnips before that, and then the big gourd vegetables like pumpkins were easier to carve.
Yeah, I would guess so.
But the very often the adorning of masks or usually they had something to do with the totems that were sacred to the indigenous peoples of Europe would be donned as part of the festivities as well. And There are other festivals like Cremona amongst the Romans, which happened about the same time of the year, in which you had a kind of trick-or-treat, a gift exchange sort of a thing. It was at the height of the harvest. Eventually, the church, once it moved out into Europe, would basically establish this rigorous mission to Christianize what had been previously pagan sites or sites of worship. They typically turned them into churches or shrines or sanctuaries of one sort or another, the logic being that people were already used to gathering at these sites. And it would just be simpler to build churches and cathedrals and things like that over them. And the same kind of logic was eventually applied to once the Roman Catholic Church in particular began to move out into Europe. Same logic was applied to the calendar year. You know, let's canonize, you know, some of these festivals and turn them into at least superficially Christian festivals, so that the people, you know, who are used to gathering at that time of the year, you know, can still gather, but do so under the auspices of, you know, the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was an appropriation, basically, of these older festivals and practices without completely being able to do away with all of the elements that had existed before they were canonized.
Hmm.
And that's really kind of the first, what you might say, the ancient or the medieval phase would be. With the advent of Luther and Protestantism, most Protestants didn't see any use for Halloween, and it's why you see a sort of bifurcated tradition once people from Western Europe in particular start to go to America during the colonial period. You know, in the South where you had Anglicans and Catholics, they were more wont to celebrate things like Halloween. And in the North, you had the more Puritan and Separatist and Quaker traditions and things like that. You didn't really see the need to have these sort of pagan leftovers, if you will. But it's through these conduits that later waves of immigrants, particularly from Ireland in the 1840s, that the celebration was brought over and, within a generation is pretty thoroughly Americanized. That is to say that certainly All Hallows Eve, the canonized version of Halloween, and on the following All Saints Day, were in America since the colonial times. But it's really this new influx of immigrants in the middle of the 19th century from Ireland, sort of cast aside by the potato famine that occurred in the 1840s, that bring these traditions and sort of reinvigorate the Halloween in its nascent form that had been in America. And like I say, within a generation, it becomes a firmly American tradition. And in the 20th century, its embracing is just exponential, you know, with things like Halloween parades and costume parties. And, film that was no doubt inspired by embracing these sorts of ideas.
It's arguably it's become the second most popular holiday in the American calendar every year after Christmas.
Well, if we're to believe the metrics, yeah, it does appear so. people. For one reason or another, I've seen a score of sociologists and anthropologists who say that, on some level we need that. That's why we practice it as a society, whether it's the dressing up or, decorating or what have you. But, in many cases, that seems to obfuscate really the deeper, truer, darker nature mm-hmm. of Halloween. But most of that is a kind of frivolity. But as I say, to use the pun, it masks a much darker persona behind Halloween.
You mentioned the influence of the Roman mythology on the holiday, and lately I've been doing a lot of reading on the cosmology of the ancient Near East, the ancient world, and it's becoming pretty clear to me, and you know, scholars who've actually researched this. I'm not, you know, this is not new or unique to me, that much of what the Romans and Greeks incorporated into their cosmologies originated in the ancient Near East.
That's very true. So much so that you know, in the classical literature, you read lesser the Greeks, but more the Romans. You hear them talking about things like the Chaldean numbers, or
right.
In Greek tradition, there are several periods of what scholars have called Orientalizing. You know, this effect of the ancient Near East on the Greek world, and so. Very clearly. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the Greeks believe that a number of their gods came from the East.
And right.
There's definitely this flow of influence, this diffusion of influence
right.
on the classical world.
Well, it's pretty clear that the rise of the Olympians, Zeus and his group displacing the Titans, Cronus and his group, and of course Cronus supplanting Uranus as the chief god, is taken from myths that were commonly known among the Hurrians and the Hittites. And before that, you could trace it back to the Sumerians, where you had Anu, the sky god, who was replaced by Enlil, who was then later replaced by Marduk, changed the names to Anu, Kumarbi, and Teshub in the Hurrian myth. And then, you know, you translate it over the Greek and the aspects of the story, the main points of the story are basically the same. The Greeks also had a lot of, the ancient Near East, you find a collection of rising and dying gods like Adonis, Melkart, Osiris. Well, Osiris is dying and dead. He just stayed dead, which is why he was always green. But Tammuz, who would die in the fall when vegetation turned brown, but then come back again in the springtime. When things started to green up again, is the Halloween, what link is there, if any, between the annual Halloween celebration and the annual death of the dying and rising god?
I would say that there's a very integral link, because the, you know, in its nascent form, Halloween or Samhain or whatever, you know, appellation the various indigenous groups in Europe called it. It's closely linked with this seasonal change, and it's linked with the harvest. You know, you mentioned Osiris a moment ago. Yeah, even though he remained the sort of steward of the land of the dead, he was still the fertility deity. He was still in charge of the rising and falling of crops. And you find these kinds of chthonic deities. In many cases, who are associated with both fertility, but also kind of, you know, maybe some link to the land of the dead, or the land of the mystical, land of the gods, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I would say, looking at it through the lens of kind of a monomythic analysis, I would say that there's a very integral link between those kinds of deities and the time of year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just something that occurred to me while you were describing the holiday in broad terms, that certainly the timing of the season seemed to fit. So how did these other monsters that have become prominent tropes in our annual celebration of Halloween, the mummies, ghosts, witches, vampires, what role did they play in this? I mean, were they always part of the mythos at this time of year, or have they been attached to it, you know, as in recent years?
I would say I'd say primarily the latter. I wouldn't say that there's necessarily a direct correlation between each of those kinds of, you know, monsters or chimera or whatever to the time of year. What it speaks to, I think, of course, is for those of us who are believers or Christians, you know, we can see that there's definitely a satanic agenda behind that. But the festival has in its current form has become a kind of catch-all for, you know, the various kinds of monsters and creatures that have become associated with not just Halloween, but you know, horror literature, the horror genre in literature and media and things of that sort. That's why I say that it seems to be a kind of catch-all for just, you know, every mortifying, horrendous sort of wicked creature. You know, none of these things, although they're sort of, you know, caricatured during this time of the year, none of these things in their folkloric, realistic forms are very friendly or amusing or comical at all.
Right, right.
Interestingly, you know, the connection on a very deep level may come from the fact that, again, Halloween in its embryonic form, in its youngest form, did put to the fore this removal of the veil between our world and the land of the dead or the land of spirits. I tend to think that there's probably some connection there. It's difficult to say that, you know, I should say that this time of the year is definitely a catch-all. I mean, it's difficult to argue with that kind of logic, mm-hmm. particularly from a biblical perspective.
Yeah. In other words, it's no coincidence that not only have these various archetypical monsters been attached to the holiday, but as time has gone on, as we've discussed in past years, that they've become more mainstreamed. I mean, vampires have gone from being characters of horror, objects of horror, and werewolves, objects of horror, who wanted only to drain, exsanguinate you, and perhaps consume your flesh, to being anti-heroes, you know, sex symbols.
Yeah, they've all become teen heartthrobs and rock stars, you know, and that image has also been applied to, you know, outside of vampires, it's also been applied to, you know, werewolves, and I think even Frankenstein has had his time as a GQ model.
Yeah,
I'll say that in passing. But
who's the Aaron Eckhart played the monster in a recent film and was portrayed as a hero?
That's right. That's right.
Exactly. Well, in fact, and in the recent series on Stars called Penny Dreadful, the monster character was actually the most human of all the characters in the series.
That's right. In fact, he took the name of a melancholy poet.
John Clare.
John Clare, that's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, interestingly, he was of all of the, and they had all of the main monster groups in there except for the mummy, I think, and that was perhaps seeded if they'd done a fourth season there, because one of the characters was sent off to Egypt, and we thought, okay, well, maybe he's back next year for, you know, the mummy storyline. But they had the werewolf, they had the vampires, they had the demons and devil, witches, and Frankenstein's monster. Victor Frankenstein was one of the characters in the storyline, but his monster was,
that's right,
of all of them, the human characters included, the most human of the bunch. It was, and it's interesting, not to derail the conversation, but just interesting how film and television series will do that. They will take, for example, a transhumanist worldview. And while presenting a film in which that storyline or that technology leads to complications, it's the enhanced humans are typically portrayed in a very sympathetic light. So even while it is purporting to warn us about the dangers of the technology, the product of the technology are usually portrayed favorably. And that was the case in Penny Dreadful, but, you know, the Twilight series and, you know, any number of other films in recent years, The Vampire Diaries, we talked about before, you know, Anne Rice and her work have taken what would be the embodiment of the Antichrist spirit, looking at the vampire particularly, one who wants to drain your blood so he can live forever instead of shedding his blood so that his followers could live forever, as in the case of Jesus, and making the vampire a hero.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's...
Yeah, I'm sorry, I keep interrupting you.
No, go ahead, jump in.
No, I'll only nod assent to everything that you just said. I mean, we've turned the villain clearly on its head in the popular media, and it's really Orwellian in a way what's happened to the vampire, because traditionally the vampire, just stripping the literary element of it away and looking at it the purely anthropological, there's nothing redemptive about the vampire or, you know, ghouls or any of these other kinds of creatures at all. They seek only to mimic their roots, which I've argued before go back to the Antediluvian world and the giants.
Mm-hmm.
To consume and subjugate and oppress.
And it surprises me how willingly Christians ignore that, I think, that very obvious and very sharp contrast between Christ and between the vampire. In fact, in a piece that I wrote for one of the anthologies that Tom Horn published, God's Ghostbusters, I did a chapter. Thank you. Like I'm taking credit for the whole book. I can only speak to my chapter. Well, and Sharon's chapter, which was awesome on the concept of virtual sin, people who are addicted to horror or gore or torture porn films, and torture porn, I don't mean literal sexual pornography, but films that glorify the shedding of blood and the infliction of inflicting pain on others, even if it's being done in a virtual setting, which Hollywood production obviously would. It's all mock gore. It's all staged. It's all pretend. But what is it doing to you spiritually as you're, you know, taking that in and reveling in it? It's amazing to me how many professing Christians are okay with the works of Stephanie Meyer, for example, the Twilight series, or Walking Dead, you know, the glorification of cannibalism, you know, the zombies. It is just a little surprising. I mean, and I'd appreciate a good horror film, but you reach a point where, for example, in the Saw movies, where the shedding of blood in the first film was, I would argue, part of the plot that you really couldn't do without. But the sequels, I thought, were just there to see how far they could stretch the envelope in the depiction of, shedding blood and dismemberment and so on. I didn't see anything redeeming in the sequels to the original movie Saw. But a lot of folks are just in their minds will say, well, this is all pretend, so it doesn't really count. And I think Sharon made a very good case in her chapter, but I got derailed. My own chapter in that book, I made reference to your theory, belief, that perhaps the vampire concept of the vampire stems from the Nephilim, who, according to Second Temple Jewish literature, the Enochian literature, were cannibals, were blood drinkers, and certainly would have made such an impression on the survivors of the flood that those stories would have been passed down generation to generation. And a discernment ministry took that as evidence that we were trying to somehow twist the gospel I mean, I was startled that somebody would point to that and say that this guy is trying to, you know, come up with some weird new prophetic paradigm, and I don't know.
That's amazing, actually.
I think much of the criticism drawn by the likes of Tom Horn and L.A. Marzulli comes from people who do not accept the giants of Genesis 6 as literal giants. And I think if you reject that, then everything that stems from that in terms of speculation or conclusions about who the giants were, what their impact was on history, and what role they might play in prophecy, you know, people who just, they aren't even on board with the concept that giants ever existed will obviously think that you're just making stuff up as you go, I suppose. So anyway,
I would agree with that. But, you know, the counter to that argument for me is, and others too, has always been, you know, look, the language says what it says. If you, even if you're just looking at it from the perspective of intellectual history, just what the Jews thought. This is what they thought. This is what they believed.
Right.
And when you infuse that with the belief that, okay, these authors were working under God's inspiration, they were working with events that they had seen and experienced, then the passages become more momentous.
Right. And when you have men who lived with, walked with, learned from Jesus, like Peter and Jude, who make reference to that particular episode, mm-hmm. You would assume that they would have had access to firsthand knowledge. So I'm going to defer to them and the fact that they understood it to be real, rather than assume that 2,000 years further on, because we're more scientific, that we know better. But anyway, I didn't mean to turn this into a rant against discernment ministries. I was just it popped up in my mind because it kind of surprised me, and I had forgotten about it until we started talking again. But the entire concept of the vampire. Let's move on to the topic of your forthcoming book. I'm not going to get this right. Sanguis.
That's it.
So that is the Latin pronunciation. What does the title refer to, and how do you approach this topic?
Well, the title literally means blood. I mean, it's a reference to the medium upon which not only vampires feed, but they manifest. There's always this concurrent theme of blood running through all the stories of vampires. I thought, what better title to go with than the Latin word for blood? And I think maybe I chose the title also because of some of the characters that are involved in the narrative itself. And we can certainly get into the meat and potatoes of that as we go along here. But it's... It's kind of a, not that I've never written fiction before, but this would really actually be my first fiction novel. It's basically a look at vampirism through the lens of the Bible, through the lens of Christianity.
Well, this would be different because, again, in recent years, it seems that vampires, when they are written about, are the object of adoration, sex symbols, especially when it's especially in the novels that are aimed at a younger reader.
Certainly. Well, I'm just ready to put the vampire back in his place. My favorite vampire stories and novels are always where the vampire was in his place. He was clearly the villain. Even if he was seductive and debonair, the readership understood that he was still the villain, and he was, you know, the heroes put him in his place. And
Well, even that's biblical because we're told in Scripture that even Satan himself can appear as an angel of light. So certainly an Antichrist character like the vampire would, the fact that he would appear as a very appealing character outwardly is no surprise at all.
Correct. And there are a host of, there's actually not just one villain, there are a host of a number of these little nasties running throughout the narrative. But I saw this as a chance to not only crank out what I thought was an entertaining story, but also to kind of put some of these topics out for consideration concerning, what is a Christian to make of the vampire? Not only as an idea, but as a potential reality. And what would that, if there were people who are grounded in biblical faith, what would the struggle between those kinds of people and, a vampire demonic spirit, what would that look like?
Well, yeah. Now, how do you approach that? Because in the early stories, the Bram Stoker, from Bram Stoker onward, and Stoker really took the genre to he really sort of set the bar for the genre, because everything since Stoker, every vampire has some debt to his Count Dracula. But Count Dracula even goes back a little further. If you the first of the really debonair, suave, aristocratic vampires was Lord Ruthven, and I can't remember the name of the author who wrote that short story, but clearly when Abraham Van Helsing was pursuing Dracula, even in the 1933 movie with Bela Lugosi, aspects, or at least the symbols of Christianity, were very important to the storyline. So how do you approach this?
Well, in much the same way. I mean, anybody who writes a vampire novel in some respect is beholden to Stoker for some of the standards that he put in the genre. But I'm trying to go back to those original standards in some respect and kind of eschew the approaches that have been taken, in the print genre over the last, 40 years or so, 40 or 50 years. But it's built on not only the research that I've done on vampires, but it's also built on, some life experiences, and it's set in, this isn't exactly a spoiler alert. I'm not really giving away the plot or anything, but, it's set in, I use things that were familiar with me.
Right.
Almost the way that Stephen King, takes the approach, he writes things.
Sets everything in Maine.
In Maine.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, this is a good formula. It's something that I think I can do, And so I took elements of familiarity. And so the story centers around a group of friends. They're all Christians. They grew up together. There's a professor of classics. There's a officer in the Army National Guard. There's a deputy sheriff, contractor. Two of the guys are brothers. They've all grown up together, camping and hunting and fishing and playing in the marching band together. And, these guys they know each other too well, and, they can finish each other's sentences.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's really, really close-knit group of people. One is returning home basically to take over his grandmother's little stock farm she had left him, and he accepts a position at the university and is just trying to settle in, trying to get to, not really reconnect with his friends. He'd never really lost touch with them, but they were, spending time together again. He was trying to make the place home again. And the college that he accepted the post at had been basically refurbished. It was an old, this is actually based on a true story. I modeled the hometown a little bit after my own, I should say that I modeled the town that the events take place in, a little bit after my own hometown. And there used to be a college there that operated in the 1930s, 20s or 30s. It was a kind of finishing college, just a small liberal arts Presbyterian mm-hmm. school. And so I had these oil tycoons move in and refurbish the college and started it over again, and that's how the guy gets the post, and that's kind of where the story starts.
By the way, not to interrupt here, but for people who are hearing the noise in the background here, and if you're watching this on YouTube, just on the other side of that window that you see reflected in my eyeglasses, Sharon is out there on our yard tractor, so... you know, we're trying to not literally trying to make hay while the sun shines, because our neighbor takes care of the hay portion of the 10 acres here. But we've got a beautiful day, and so and the yard tractor's got a brand new battery, so Sharon's taking advantage of it. And so you'll hear that going past the studio that we've set up here periodically throughout the conversation. So in case you're wondering what's going on outside, it's Sharon on the Troy Belt.
It just adds spice to the interview. That's all.
Right. Well, you but, know, building on what you know is not unusual. That's something authors do a lot. That's why in my novel, The God Conspiracy, pretty much everything was set in St. Louis and Chicago. So,
surely, yeah. It's a very organic, you know, kind of narrative in that respect. But these oil tycoons are refurbished. They're buying a property around town. Not to reveal too much, but you know, it turns out that these tycoons are a little more than just oil tycoons. In other words, they're not just sucking oil out of the ground.
Okay.
You've got a, one of the things that I explored with one of the characters, one of the main villains was how a demonic vampire spirit might manipulate matter and how long they might manipulate matter. I heard Sean Manchester, who's a prominent vampire researcher, say one time that he thought vampires operated in a kind of anti-time that allowed them to do things in linear time that other, you know, people that live in this reality cannot. Hmm. And I always thought that was interesting. And it would go a long way towards explaining the length of you know, of a vampire's life. And so I wrote that into all of the villains, but this one in particular, who was the oldest, and he was actually a Roman.
Ah.
So this fellow, you know, is almost 2,000 years old. It was fun to look at characters like that and play with some of the potentialities and what would the biblical narrative allow, you know, in terms of what these things could do. And I set it all up with a kind of dramatization of scenes from the Book of Enoch.
Okay.
And taking it back to the roots of, taking vampirism back to the roots of the giant, you know, the giants and their kind of their activities and their behavior and their bloodlust and the pronunciation of God's judgment by Enoch upon the watchers and their progeny, the giants, you know, that their giants' spirits would be cursed to roam the earth and forever thirsty and hungry but never sated. This is all in the... it's actually in a prologue to the book that sort of sets up the tone of the rest of the narrative. But in many ways, it's the team of heroes against the team of villains, rather than the team of heroes against one particular villain, like mm-hmm. you have in Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Right.
But that sort of camaraderie is there amongst these men, these young men who have, you know, they share faith, they've shared experiences. They've gone out into the professional world. They've acquired skills, and now all of that is coming to bear against these tycoons who have moved into town are, and are just gobbling up, you know, every part of everything that they love.
It's really interesting that, that you're doing this now, because at the same time that you're working on this, Sharon is working on a series that she's been plotting in her mind for years. In fact, she had laid out some of the bones of the story that she is writing now, even before we'd met. Now, hers is set back in the Victorian era. In fact, kind of builds on Jack the Ripper and the Ripper murders as a sort of a jumping off point. Are you familiar with the series Ripper Street at all?
I've heard of it. I've never watched it, though.
Well, it's a... starts where the Ripper murders basically end, officially end anyway, and examines some of the characters who were prominent in the investigation, like Edmund Reed, Fred Eberlein, who was the chief inspector, led the investigation. Reed, who was took over the investigation.
This is a TV series, right?
Yeah, it was on BBC, and Amazon has picked it up for the last couple seasons. So seasons 4 and 5 are Amazon only, I think. BBC America's got season 4, and I think season 5 may just be on Amazon only, Amazon Prime. But taking that kind of a storyline and then doing what you're doing, filtering it through a biblical lens, and then coming out with a team of believers who are basically working against a team or a conspiratorial group of a variety of monster types, but there are vampires in there as part of the group that they're facing, because ultimately the enemy is coming from the same source, the principalities and powers who rebelled against God. But she just felt led that, you know, now was finally the time to get this together and put it out. And at the same time, you know, great minds must think alike, because you're following the same path.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I have a couple of other books planned, and they'll respectively deal with witches and then werewolves.
Very cool. Very cool. So in the approach of your heroes, this team of friends who find themselves confronting this new evil in their community, how would your approach, looking at this from a biblical perspective, differ from what people are used to seeing or reading in vampire fiction?
Well, what people a lot of it will be familiar. You know, there is the hunt and the chase, but people are not going to find stakes being driven through hearts or that sort of thing. This is going to be a war of prayer and fasting. Now, there'll be some physical confrontation. You have to include those sorts of things in these sort of physical narratives. But that's something that I wanted to bring very much to the fore, is that this is not just, you know, it's not a confrontation that takes place in a, you know, on an open field in a battlefield or a cemetery or something like that, or an old church or whatever. You know, this is a war that takes place on these people's knees, you know, oftentimes before they confront each other. So that was something I wanted to draw very much to the fore, because that's the way Jesus did it. You know, that's the way he told his disciples. Prayer and fasting. And then when the confrontation comes up, the preparation is there. But there are some, what you might call heated scenes, where some physical confrontation is necessary, but this is largely a prayer war that's taking place.
And that even in the older versions of the Dracula story, you know, the James Whale film, we don't really see, and I said 33, I guess it was 1931, wasn't it? I'll have to look it up. But anyway, the James Whale film, Bela Lugosi film, prayer was not part of the weaponry. It was holy water, it was the crucifix, and then the stake through the heart, ultimately, and sunlight, I guess. But as we've talked before, as as God was written out of the more modern vampire films, it became more and more difficult for writers to come up with a secular rationale, I guess, a premise for the existence of vampires in the first place. You know, why, if there's no God, if prayer is not effective, if this is not a spiritual war, then why would the crucifix and the holy water have any influence, have any effect at all on a vampire? What's the purpose of that? The original movie Fright Night, I thought, had a wonderful line where the vampire played by Chris Sarandon faced the teenage hero who was holding up the cross and just grabs that out of his hand and crushes it and said, "This only works if you believe it." Mm-hmm. You know, the cross is ineffective if you don't believe in it. Like, well, you know, that's more true than the writer of that script probably realized.
Right. Exactly. And those are the kind of elements that I have in this book, and people, I think, will see that. You know, this is a story of yes, it's a war being waged against vampires, but it's a war being waged with biblically grounded ideas, with biblically grounded practices. And yes, each of our heroes has to use their particular skills to find out the sort of earthly machinations of the villain. But it all comes down to prayer. It all comes down to the perseverance and faith of all of our heroes, and indeed other members of the community, to finally come to a solution against the vampires.
Well, that's something I'm looking forward to reading. That was in the God Conspiracy, something I tried to incorporate into the storyline, which was more of a contemporary political conspiracy thriller, if you will. And if I can take a moment to plug it, by the way, if you're curious, the book is in audio book format now, and I've been releasing it for free in episodes on my YouTube channel, which if you're watching, you're already on the YouTube channel. So youtube.com/Derek Gilbert, look at the playlist that says The God Conspiracy, and you can just listen to the book for free. The response when it was released was interesting, because I originally released it, I guess 9 years ago, and did it in the same format through a website that specialized in releasing audio book versions in episodes. And there were some people who thought the plot was great, but they hated the fact that religion was in it. Nobody actually deals with things like that. Nobody prays like that before they start out on a road trip. It's like, well, you just don't know the right people. I mean, 20 years ago, I would have thought the same thing, but I've come around. Because I've, you know, been because the Holy Spirit, because God is patient with me. And, you know, after applying the spiritual 2x4 to my head, I was at least smart enough to open my eyes and say, well, maybe I need to rethink my worldview. And but yeah, it was funny how there were people who liked the plot, liked the storyline. And I suspect you'll get some of this too, which is why I mentioned it. People who like the plot, like the storyline, but find the religious part offensive, which gets back to my earlier comment. You can't really tell an authentic vampire story if you leave that aspect out, because the vampire is as far removed, is as much antichrist. If you were to diagram it, you know, on a 360 degree scale, at the 180 degree point from Christ would be the vampire.
Exactly. Exactly. And so by default, you can't tell a complete vampire story,
right,
without mentioning religion, and specifically biblical Christianity.
Exactly. The secular vampire stories always have a hole missing where the motivation should be for the villain.
Yes, and I would argue that the story suffers because of it. It just doesn't
agree.
It doesn't have the pace or tempo that the more complete vampire narratives have.
Yeah, I agree. So very definitely looking forward to seeing the story when it's out. Now, the books that you've planned with the other monsters, is this going to be a series, or are you going to each one going to be standalone?
It is a series. It will include the same line of characters and the same, you know, the vampire problem is the first sort of twitching of the veil, if I can borrow a phrase from Bram Stoker, of the problems, you know, on the horizon. You know, it, in many ways, it's a timely. I think it's a timely story because of what seems to be almost the exponential ramping up of supernatural phenomena in our own time.
Yeah. Yeah, and sadly, secularists are missing a lot of this. I think that when you're saying supernatural phenomenon, it's not necessarily either or phenomena. It's not even ghost sightings or UFO sightings or things like that. I think just looking at the spread of mindless what appears to the secular eye as mindless evil is a manifestation of the supernatural. The rise of the Islamic State in the Middle East. The so-called zombie apocalypse here in the United States over the last couple of years, where you get these random attacks of people who display superhuman strength and a single-minded desire to consume an enemy, their victim, which is just horrific. And again, makes no sense when you look at it through secular eyes. Well, the person must have been on drugs. Well, I'm sorry, drugs don't account for it. So, no, I agree. I think we're living at a time of almost an unprecedented demonic outpouring I will say again, yeah. 20 years ago, if I'd heard myself talking like this, I'd have thought, okay, severe head trauma, maybe, because this is not how I was raised to think.
Well, even for those of us who are, raised in the church, I mean, for ones that are, paying attention with a discerning eye to the events that transpire, almost daily. Who would have thought that we'd see such frequency passing, across our news tickers on our, our iPads?
Yeah.
It's staggering. We're living in times when prophecy is being fulfilled almost every day.
Right. Yeah, Carl Gallup's new book, When the Lion Roars, goes into that, and the thing that I appreciate most about the book, it's a great book in that it documents things that are happening around us that are fulfilling ancient prophecies, but he avoids completely the argument of, okay, what order is all this going to happen? The timeline and, pre, mid, post, it just forget all of that. Let's set that aside. Let's look at the fact that the stuff is being fulfilled, and maybe we can get some more pastors and some more churches to actually start teaching and talking about prophecy with their congregations, because most of the church, the vast majority of Christians around the world, are amillennial. There are no prophecies that need to be fulfilled, really. We're just going to, Jesus will come back one day and then everything will be good. And I know I'm going to get emails. Forgive me for being so broad in my description of amillennialism. I know that there are different elements to the beliefs. I made a statement like that on Skywatch TV a few weeks ago and got a couple of emails from folks who are amillennial and pointing out that I had misrepresented their beliefs, but they didn't agree with each other. So that's a very broad brush. So I please understand if you're listening, I know that. And I'm not trying to demean anybody's beliefs or be condescending here. Just saying that as we are looking at prophecy and prophetic fulfillment, maybe we should focus on that and the fact that it's being fulfilled rather than arguing about how or in what order, or is it in the right order, or, and what happens next. That doesn't matter. Our job, our prime directive is to not worry really about that, to be aware of it, to observe it, to pay attention to the signs of the changing of the season, but mainly to spread the gospel. And
precisely.
We have a tendency to get into circular firing squads, and certain friends of ours have been lightning rods for that kind of criticism. And we're spending so much time attacking other brothers and sisters within the faith that we're not witnessing, and we're not making a very good witness to those who are still outside the camp.
So, indeed.
Well, hopefully this now. How will this be received, do you think, by people who aren't already Christians? And I shouldn't have detoured, through all of that stuff after my observation about my previous novel. Should have gone right to this question. Will there be people who will reject the novel, do you think? because just the presence of the Christian theme in it is a turnoff.
I suspect that, I mean, there's always going to be that facet of readership that's not going to be completely satisfied with the narrative and, or, you know, critically rejected outright. Mm-hmm. I'm expecting that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think that I've got a fair enough grasp on history, given all the years that I've devoted to its study, that I've grafted on enough of the sort of Indiana Jones element, you know, within the story to kind of give it that luster that might salvage some of that readership. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I expect that there will be those who just dismiss it outright as, oh, it was a great book up until blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, until they mention Jesus. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, it's a risk you have to take. We can't avoid that aspect of the storyline as a believer. It's like trying to deny gravity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And you know, again, I'll say, 20 years ago, hearing myself talk like that would have thought something traumatic had happened to realign my worldview in the intervening
right.
years. But, well, brother, when is the book going to be available?
The book should be available October the 31st.
Oh, perfect. So, as this program will
go to my website and find a number of avenues to purchase the book at burtonbeyond.com. Oh, or they can go to the Institute of Biblical Anthropology website, tioba.org, and find much the same.
Well, awesome. As this program is going to be uploaded for October 30th, this is just a day in advance of the release date. So tomorrow, you watching and listening at home, tomorrow, go to the website, burtonbeyond.com, and buy a copy of Sanguis. Perhaps get multiple copies if you have friends who are fascinated with vampire fiction, who've not been willing to listen, perhaps, to anyone suggest that perhaps this is an anti-Christian type of fiction, an anti-Christian hero. This would be a perhaps a way to begin disabusing them of that notion. Judd, it's always an education talking with you, brother, and I've got some historical things I want to run past you as soon as we cut off the mic here.
Sounds great.
All right, Judd Burton, burtonbeyond.com, and the website for the Institute of Biblical Anthropology, again, is...
TIOBA.org, and the other is burtonbeyond.com.
Links to both in the show notes at vftb.net. Judd, thanks for your time. We'll talk again soon. Find links to Judd's website in the show notes at vftb.net, and if you're watching this on video, of course, at youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. Also put a link to where you can buy the book, Interview with the Giant, Ethnohistorical Notes on the Nephilim. Well worth adding to your reference library, and looking forward to reading the novel Sanguis when it is finally available. This week in the news, we continue this slow step that march toward war with Russia, and I don't really understand the rationale behind it. Progressive news organizations, which is almost a, you know, repeating yourself, are adding to this drumbeat. That somehow the United States is obligated to intervene in Syria and to do so in a way that prevents Russia from assisting the government of Bashar al-Assad, who invited the Russians to participate in the civil war taking place there against the government. Without this understanding that setting up a no-fly zone, which Hillary Clinton and many of these progressive media pundits are calling for, would necessarily require being prepared to shoot down Russian planes and risking a nuclear war with Russia over Syria, which absolutely makes no sense at all. Now, there have been some very prominent Christians, typically liberal Christians, folks like Brian McLaren, Tony Campolo, Jen Hatmaker, who have been very public in saying, you know, Donald Trump is reprehensible, he's a bad human being, and we shouldn't vote for him. I understand why Christians have problems with Donald Trump. I mean, you look at the course of his life, and he's not exactly somebody you would point to as a role model for your children. I get that. But look at the policies that Hillary Clinton has supported in recent history. Look at all of the revelations that have come out from the emails that have been released by WikiLeaks. which the Democratic campaign and the president are blaming on Russia. As it turns out, John Podesta fell for one of the oldest internet phishing scams in the book, you know, a bogus email saying, "Ooh, somebody hacked your email account. Log in here and give us your new password." And of course, that was a way for scammers to get Mr. Podesta's password, which is how they accessed his, I think 33,000 emails have now been released by WikiLeaks. But going through that body of emails, it becomes very clear that there's very tight little click between the Democratic National Committee and the press. And there's been some illegal collaboration between the Democratic National Committee and the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign, including involvement in dirty tricks like hiring agitators to go stir up trouble at Donald Trump rallies. But that's small potatoes compared to what Hillary Clinton did as Secretary of State, in which she advocated policies that have literally resulted in a failed state in Libya, nearly failed states in Iraq and Syria and Ukraine, which, you know, forget Syria, Ukraine could be the trigger that sets off this chain reaction, resulting in a nuclear war. You know, Doug Woodward put out a book about this last year. And a lot of people were critical of Doug, saying he's an alarmist and this is, you know, no way U.S. is going to war with Russia. Well, if you look at the news since that book was released, you begin to see Doug was onto something. Because the elites who are controlling the political course of the West, not just the United States, but NATO, our Western allies, are continuously trying to poke the Russian bear and provoke it into a fight. Now, the Russians may not want to go to war over Syria either, but they are not going to tolerate Ukraine becoming a NATO member, which is what Hillary wants. So think what you will of Donald Trump. And I address this to you, Jen Hentmaker. Think what you will of Donald Trump as a person. But if you think his policies are more dangerous than Hillary Clinton's, then you are naive. That's all there is to it. Hillary Clinton's foreign policy is frankly suicidal. It is psychotic. Now, again, I wish we had a better candidate running as a Republican or as any other party, libertarian, you know, than Donald Trump. But if for no other reason than he's driving the neocons crazy and upsetting the apple cart of the elites running the Republican Party, seeing him in office would be a good thing. Now, whether he'll be able to do anything as president still remains to be seen. I don't think any president has the power to get done what most of us Americans think the president can do. And those who've tried in history wind up the victim of a lone gunman. And we Americans don't like to think this. I mean, Democrats were all in a tizzy when Mr. Trump said that he wouldn't commit to honoring the results of the election. And Democrats were freaking out. I mean, he's threatening the very foundation of America's democracy, the peaceful transfer of power from one party to another, forgetting that in 2000, the Democrats held up the election for weeks on end as they contested the results in Florida. So they were basically blowing a gasket because Donald Trump didn't promise to be a better loser than Al Gore. This is why I've got my Cubs cap on, because at least the World Series is keeping me sane this week. I've been avoiding talk radio, political talk radio, and the talking cable news shows at night because, frankly, I'd be tempted to throw a brick through the television screen. A pox on both their houses. And again, this is a distraction. I've said this before, as a Christian, this is really a distraction from our prime directive, our main goal, as laid out for us by Jesus himself. He did not say, go forth to the ends of the earth and spread political action committees to elect the proper judges to the Supreme Court. No, he said, go forth, make disciples of all nations. And we can do that regardless of whoever is in office. Even if doing so means perhaps giving up our freedom. So be it. That was the price that the apostles paid in the first century, and we should be prepared for the same. Because Jesus warned us and warned all of his followers that we would suffer tribulation in this life. Being a Christian does not mean an easy road. And anyone who says otherwise, anyone who says that saying the right prayer or being a follower of Jesus Christ is a guarantee of health and wealth, Well, that person is selling something. Coming up in A View from the Bunker, Doug Overmyer, the man behind Sears Sea Ministries, which is a much-needed ministry in this day and age, one who counsels people who have been blessed or perhaps cursed with the ability to see into the spirit realm, especially pastors. How do you deal with people in your congregation that claim this ability? Doug has a new book out called Peace in Your House, Spiritual Cleansing of Life and Land, and that will be the topic of our next program here on A View from the Bunker. Got a few other programs in the works that we will unveil as soon as I confirm dates. Contacted by Pastor Billy Crone the other day. He's got a new book on the rapture, and we will likely be talking to him in the next few weeks as well. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, continues a week of study each week on the Old Testament and the New Testament as we go through the Bible in chronological order. We usually post those studies. We don't do it live to the internet, but we do post them by about midday Sunday, and all of the archives are available for your download beginning at Genesis 1:1 at gilberthouse.org. And every Monday, release another episode of The God Conspiracy. That's my novel, sort of a supernatural conspiracy thriller. We're up to episode 9, I believe. That's only about a third of the way into the book, but things are getting good if you're following the storyline, and you can find those beginning with the prelude, the introduction, at The God Conspiracy, all one word, thegodconspiracy.tk. Or if you're subscribed to the YouTube channel here, you'll get notice every time a new one posts. Again, those are posted every Monday morning at 9, a new episode of The God Conspiracy. We appreciate you taking the time to give us a rating or a review, iTunes, Stitcher, wherever else you download this to your podcatcher. And of course, we discuss these issues at the Facebook page. So log on to Facebook, give us a like at facebook.com/viewfromthebunker, which is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.